Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. I am Brett Winton, ARK Invest Chief Futurist. We have a great show for you today. I and Kathy, our fearless leader, will be talking to Sarah Friar, the CFO of OpenAI. We cover a lot of ground. We talk about how they're going to price their products, how they allocate capital. Sarah alludes to the fact that she doesn't know how to value the business, but we have an idea. When we invested in OpenAI, we approached it from two different ways. One, we think the foundation model layer in the value chain will be worth between $15 and $20 trillion by 2030. The way we get there is we think that AI software generally is going to raise the productivity of knowledge workers by 4 to 5x. There's $30 trillion in knowledge work wages. So that's $120 trillion in kind of like productivity delivery to enterprises. And we think that the software stack as a whole will take around 10% of that productivity delivery out in revenue. So most of the benefit will accrue to, you know, enterprises and ultimately end consumers. And of that portion, some amount flows down to AI foundation model providers, you know, and at a reasonable multiple on cash flow, we think those are worth 15 to 20 trillion. So with that as a context, OpenAI is, as you know, a leading candidate to occupy that spot at 150 billion is good money in terms of value, 150 some billion in post money value. You can also look at it from revenue generation and revenue growth and say on a price to sales multiple, OpenAI is actually comparable to, you know, at least 1 or 2 years forward to many of the software as a service names in public portfolios. So there's multiple ways to underwrite the position. And our belief, and it is contingent on the fact that AI is going to continue to accelerate and become more performant for all kinds of people in all kinds of roles. Okay, so we had this conversation with Sarah on December 2nd. Since then, OpenAI has begun its 12 days of shipments. It's series of releases of new updates on its products. As I'm recording this intro, we are on day 4 of shipments. You may be listening to this on day 5 or 6 or even 7. So apologies that I can't comment on day 5 or 6, but they have given us an indication of how they're gonna actually price these higher end products, which we talked to Sarah about a little in the interview. So there is the, you know, GPT free version. You can go to ChatGPT and use it. There's the ChatGPT Plus, or the enterprise for enterprise users, that gives you unlimited access to kind of their higher end models. And just this week, they've announced ChatGPT Pro, which rather than being $20 a month for Plus, is $200 a month for Pro. So they're opting for a good, better, best pricing strategy right now. What's interesting about that Pro price point, and it gives you access to the O1 model, which is their inference time compute, kind of best in the world engine for logical reasoning, to even longer inference time. And people have, in reviews, indicated it's really great for coding and for kind of more logical, crunchy tasks. They have also layered in Sora, their video generation engine, essentially 500 videos generated a month in that Pro category. So you can imagine that they are bundling and likely in their additional product announcements, I assume this will consistently be the case, bundling, you know, effectively unlimited or nearly unlimited access to their very best products into a $200 a month type package. And we'll see what uptake looks like. But $200 a month might seem expensive, except if you're displacing, 2 hours of work a month and you're making $100 an hour, actually it pays for itself. And so the way we think about software pricing, if you're displacing, 10 hours of work and you're making $100 or $200 an hour, then you would probably be willing to pay $200 a month for the software. And so it's exciting times in AI. Things are happening quickly. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Sarah. It really is illuminating as to how OpenAI as an org operates and thinks about pricing, capital, and products. And thanks for tuning in to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. With us today, we have Sarah Friar, the CFO of OpenAI, and of course, our fearless leader, Kathy Wood, CEO, CIO, ARK Invest. Sarah, you are a engineering metallurgist by education, but you went from Goldman Sachs to Salesforce, CFO at now Block, then Square, Nextdoor CEO, and now CFO of OpenAI. And Kathy, you've kind of like parallel tracked her along the way. How did you two kind of interact over time in your careers?
Well, I had to look up when Sarah was at Goldman Sachs. She joined Goldman in 2000, which was the peak of the tech and telecom bubble, and was there until 2011. And I thought I had known Sarah's much younger than I am, but I thought I had known her through the bubble as well. I feel like we've been through it all, so. We've just known each other for a long time at AllianceBernstein. We consulted with Sarah when she was at Goldman Sachs, of course. And then we owned every one of her stocks, partly because she was there. And if she was there, we knew that the company was onto something interesting, new, interesting, different, big. Salesforce, I remember fighting the battle back then with you and Mark Benioff about software as a service. And, people just did not understand it. Oracle was slamming it every time Larry Ellison had a chance. Block we were onto and our original research brought us back to Sarah, where we basically lined up where Square at the time, now Block, its user base was in the lower income areas, and we overlaid its user base with a map, and everybody loved that, and we gained some notoriety there. And then Nextdoor, local advertising on the internet, where Sarah was the CEO, and challenging time for advertising, of course. And then OpenAI, it was just like, wow, now she's home. That's what I said to her. Okay, now you're home when she joined OpenAI. So that's how long we've known each other. And she's been either ahead of us or we've been in lockstep. And so here we are again.
It's so true. If I could for just a minute. First of all, I love that we have Sig Sigalis in common, and I just have to say Sig's name because God rest her soul. She was one of my faves of all time on Wall Street. But when Kathy really kind of hit the scene, she was absolutely the investor. You wanted to know what she was thinking. It was always such a joy to get on a phone call with her because the questions were never expected. And I kind of love that about great investors. So I'm sure this podcast is going to be a lot of fun for exactly that reason. But I think she, like me, loves to kind of often be in the unpopular places in the beginning because people don't yet understand them. Or sometimes they become unpopular because they go out in a blaze of hype and then it takes a while for reality to conform. But I think we both have often agreed on big tech shifts. And thankfully, been right many times, and let's hope that AI is also one of them. I'm quite confident.
Yeah. Can I just before we launch in, in evaluating this amazing opportunity, you also had to evaluate the question we are getting all the time you know, is this a hype cycle? You know, is this the reincarnation of the tech and telecom bubble and bust? And I know you have some interesting observations there. So why don't we start off with those before I hand it over to Brett?
I would say definitely not when it comes to the technology. So what I'm seeing in terms of our motion towards AGI, but even where we are today, it's very real. I mean, if anyone out there, if you have not yet experienced just using ChatGPT, I mean, I don't know what you're doing. The ability for it just to make your life easier from really simple tasks like, you know, what should I cook for dinner tonight? Or write me, I was sitting with my daughter this weekend, who's a sophomore in college, you know, and she needs to write a cover letter, right? Just all of these things that just make your life a lot easier. It feels revolutionary. And I think this is only when it's still in its, you know, early stage of what the thing will be. Do I believe that it's going to be the next big platform shift? I do, wholeheartedly. In the same way I truly believed in the shift to the cloud, and I would go to New York to meet with investors, and I would get all this pushback about how banks and governments and telcos and so on would never put their data in the cloud, ever, ever. So that, you know, there's no way the market cap of Salesforce could ever get beyond $10 billion. I feel that again, you're hearing some of that when you hear people talk about the laws of scaling are over, or there's not enough power in the world to do this. No, we are in the real beginnings of a massive platform shift. Valuations, I don't know. I leave that up to all of you. I kind of stepped out of that world, but I do love that one data point from another investor, but I'm sure Kathy has done the same analysis, saying that 2 years out from when Netscape came on the scene, right? So the first time you could really browse the internet, even have that concept, only about 2% of all of the market cap of what today we think of as internet-driven businesses existed. And I think we are that early. ChatGPT just hit its birthday. It's 2 years old. This weekend just passed. I think of investing in kind of a similar kind of way right now.
I like how you kind of drew the analogy to the cloud. And people analogize AI to a lot of different technologies. The introduction to the internet, the introduction of the computer, even the introduction of the steam engine. And yet there are also characteristics about it that are like clearly very different. It's one compared to the internet. Hey, this is expensive to serve, expensive to kind of the marginal cost of providing tokens to users is much higher than the marginal cost of providing bits to internet users, at least at the kind of platform level. How does that impact kind of like the business model and capital allocation strategy of OpenAI? Like how from the CFO's office and also corporate strategy, like how do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have a perfect answer, but as a starting point, often when I'm working with the team, we're focused on gross margin, not revenue as maybe the starting point. It reminds me a little bit of Square, because Square used to have this kind of concept of GPV, right, gross payment volume, and even then to gross revenue before you took out all of interchange and so on. And if you built your business to kind of GPV or to gross revenue, you could get really off. So you really had to be mindful all the time about margin, particularly gross margin. And so I think there's a lot of similarity when I think about building pricing models and so on here, that we have to look to the gross margin. At the same time, I don't want us to get too stuck that today's cost profile is tomorrow's cost profile. There is a lot of positive things happening on that cost profile. Number one, we are all just wonderful participants in Moore's Law. And, you know, as a metallurgist, as you said it, or a material scientist, I used to spend a lot of time thinking about silicon back in my university days, but Moore's Law is alive and well. I think the second thing we're all learning is massive more efficiency in how we run our compute. So, you know, as effectively a two-year-old company with the sort of scale we have, we're only now really learning how to serve that compute in a really efficient way. So our gross margins are just getting better and better on that front. And then I think the third thing is there's places where you will really lean into margin to stay competitive or to create ubiquity. You want people to be using it. So if you look at, for example, our API, when we first launched GPT-4 and had our API for GPT-4, the cost of that to serve to a developer to today, where we've got 4.0 mini, is literally 4.0 mini is 1/100th of the cost, like 1/100th. You don't often see that as a CFO where costs have come down that much. And that we actually price in a way where we even don't even try to make a margin off of it, because we want every developer in the world to be using it, going back to kind of that ubiquity point. And we're learning that when customers use our APIs, we get good evals, evals drive the product. So there's a very virtuous cycle there. So, you know, overall, as a CFO, I'm always looking for kind of former templates to go back to. I'm mindful that today is not tomorrow, and that you have to really think future often. And then finally, I'm thinking about, you know, that margin piece, while, you know, you have to be mindful of what it means for your business model, can also be an interesting point of, you know, competitive advantage too in how you use it. So I think there's a lot of low-hanging fruit for us right now as we build out the business model.
One of the most interesting analyses that our analysts have done, led by Brett and the various directors of research, was on exactly what you're talking about, the cost declines. And we use Wright's Law, which Wright's Law is a relative of Moore's Law. Moore's Law is a function of time. Wright's Law is a function of units. And in doing that analysis, we have learned that AI training costs are dropping 75% per year. I mean, we've never seen anything like this. Yeah. I mean, it's 3 or 4 times faster than Moore's Law, if I'm not mistaken. And AI inference costs are dropping 85 to 90% per year. So again, extraordinary. We've never seen anything like this.
I can't help myself. Because the other piece as well is that you're very early in a whole like technology industry being created. And so people get very fast to put things into cement, because you just said the word inference class, you know, and so people have in their head that we're building these data centers, and there's data centers that will do inference, data centers that will do research, and chips that do inference, and so on. And the reality is, like, I think one of our bigger breakthroughs this year, just in terms of efficiency of all of our compute, is recognizing that there is a lot of fungibility even between those two things. So, you know, which then drives more compounding efficiency, because not only are you getting closer to 100% full usage of a GPU, but you're also learning, you know, what particular research tasks actually do better and what we would have historically called an inference computer. So things like 4.0 mini that I talked about were largely done on, you know, what Azure would call fleet capacity. They weren't done in an AI supercomputer. And so again, we are still learning. And so our, you know, my goal always, even with the CFO hat on, is not to kind of put people into concrete. Like, you must allow a lot of flexibility as technology is evolving.
Yeah. I mean, it works to a cost halving every 4 or 5 months. And so if you actually like set up a strategy that is inflexible against that metric, you're going to get almost instantaneously offsides. Yeah. And with kind of the inference time compute that the O1 model represents, that's another way you can trade off like training capability for inference, where you're essentially running the model in real time for the person to produce a better result than you would otherwise need a bigger CapEx spend to do. How do you think about capital allocation within that context? Because it's like, really, like your CapEx allocation is competing with your OpEx allocation in some way. Like, how do you know, like, this is how many computers I need for like serving the product versus like investing in future products?
Yeah, that is, oh my goodness, that is, if you were living inside of OpenAI, you would know that's where we spend many cycles, brain cycles and compute cycles right now. Part of it is we have the ability to go back somewhat in history to say, okay, how much compute did we need when we created ChatGPT 3 and then 3.5? And then what did we have to think to invest to get to ChatGPT 4? And I think the good news is, like, you're only, I mean, 4 is still, or 4 and its children, 4.0, 4.mini, and so on, it's still the vast, vast majority of our revenue. So the good news is, after you've invested for multiple years afterwards, you're very much able to continue to harvest the fruit of that investment. So while I think there's also this fear that our cycle's getting shorter, I don't think they are at all, because we're hitting on the other side, about 250 million plus users, but, you know, there's 7 billion people on the planet, right? And this is human intelligence. This is electricity in your example. And so I think we're only scratching the surface of how many people will want to be able to use it. And so I think the 4.0 investment cycle outputs will last longer than I think most people think. So now as we get to O1, we now have an ability to say, okay, well, what did it take us to go train O1? And so now you project into the future and you say, okay, so for the model we want to be able to release in FY27, we know we needed to have shovels in the ground, concrete poured, data center warm shells up so that we can start to now fill that data center with the kit in order to be able to then drive, okay, what are we going to be able to do FY27 onwards? So there is a mismatch, but you have some prior art to go look to. The other kind of layer on top of this is actually, how do we think about this path to AGI? So chatbots to reasoning, where we know we're back as the frontier organization, to agents, which I think is really what FY25 will be about. And then it's how do we get from agents to agents doing kind of autonomous tasks for you, kind of day-to-day multitasking on behalf of an individual, to actual agents doing innovation. And then to get all the way back to your question, Brett, then you have to, that's kind of where I think as a finance person, the math can get hard, because you're having to kind of imagine a product that doesn't yet exist, imagine a customer for that product, imagine the price point they might be willing to pay, and imagine how much market share you will take, and then from that, what your total revenue will be. But I think we can make some ratio inference to give us the confidence to make the investments today, back to your point about capital allocation. And I think there's also just something about being a AI native as OpenAI, which is different from being a public company like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, right, the hyperscalers. It's a huge strength for us to know that as a private company, we get to lean fully in. This is all we do every day. It is in our investors are not giving us money to make money on our balance sheet. They are there for us to really win in this cycle. And we can lean forward harder than I think actually the hyperscalers can. They might have a lot of balance sheet, so we also have to be able to create the balance sheet to go make the investments. But I think we have a lot more permission because of where we are in our cycle, our focus, the fact we are out ahead right now with more users than anybody else, and with just the type of investor that we have that's giving us capital today.
So Brett, this reminds us, or me, of our disruptive versus sustained innovation. You're talking about truly disruptive. And the hyperscalers are in large part sustained innovation. We've been having a good debate internally. And I think what you just said would feed into, wait a minute, this is truly disruptive and you need to have a soul focus on it and drive it hard because it's moving so quickly. And so this notion that the Mag 6 should get such a disproportionate amount of the broad-based indexes, you know, just driving the indexes themselves, has been remarkable at a time when AI is, you know, breaking through all kinds of records we couldn't even imagine. So do you think that the bets on the hyperscalers or the Mag 6, the concentration in the markets, do you think that's going to give way to a broadening out in the market, as it usually does after a period where there's a flight to safety, I should say, and a real kind of a movement like in the 90s when the internet was stirring in the early 90s, mid 90s, took a while, but then it caught fire. And in the form of many startups and lots of M&A, which has been impeded by the FTC, but I think that's going to change.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, there's like so many threads to pull on in what you just said. I mean, number one on the Mag 6, or just generally speaking, it is definitely a shift that does, you know, scale is valuable. And clearly, NVIDIA with chips have really kind of run the table so far. It is drawing competition into the space, whether it's Google with their own TPU technology, AMD, and others. So I suspect that market forces will allow for some ultimately more differentiation on who the chip builder is. But do I think that NVIDIA doesn't continue to climb? No, because again, I think we're only in the beginning of the shift.
Right.
That said, it does feel like there should be some broadening of the market, but who's not to say it isn't based on who are the adopters of AI? And can you really prove that someone who is a first mover in their sector starts to take more of the economic rent of that sector? So it's not really a play on, you know, who's the up and comer next tech play, you know, that's going to come public and, you know, I don't know, be a chip provider or storage provider or something. But rather, if, you know, if I'm thinking about even chip manufacturer, like what if they're using agentic software to be able to build better chips? Are they going to go faster? Or what if I'm a CPG retailer? What if I'm the one that's doing all the investment? I mean, I'm not going to talk my own book completely, but I sit on the board of Walmart and I've been so impressed by Doug and team's willingness to lean in on capital spend. And that's really about just making stores and distribution centers and the whole supply chain much, much, much more efficient. But now if you layer AI into that, and are they willing to lean in and kind of spend what will be needed? And I'm not calling it because I don't think Doug's talked about it totally publicly. Yeah. But let's say they've been very willing to lean in. You're starting to see the rents really accrue to the companies that have been willing to take that kind of longer 3 to 5 year investment point of view. And I think that could be true in the banking sector. It could be true. I mean, any large part of the S&P, frankly. Healthcare is another. It feels like as I go talk to customers, there is not a segment of the economy that isn't impacted. Can I give you one more kind of, you know, when I think about the global portfolio, because I debate this, my husband's an investor too, so we debate this a lot on our hikes. How do you think about US investing then vis-a-vis Europe or rest of world? Because in a place where ability to invest in these platforms feels like it's the big competitive differentiation, what I get worried about when I'm back home in Europe is the lack of investment, actually, whether it's in power, data centers, and the overemphasis on regulation before the thing has even been invented. So, you know, I was debating this weekend. I know you all know if you look at US equities versus European equities, for example, you could make an argument, you could buy kind of the same company facing the same global market. Wouldn't you be much better off buying the European company because of the difference in multiple? But, you know, when I listen to companies and what their appetite is for investment, that's where I get really interested in where this cycle goes next. And that broadening of the market, maybe it's just sectorial broadening rather than per se more companies that look like the next Google or the next Amazon broadening.
Yeah, I think, we've also learned from a company like Palantir that they have been pulling employees out of Europe because it's almost impossible to work there without feeling, okay, we're going to be fined to the tune of 4% of our revenue because inadvertently we hit up against some privacy regulation and we didn't even know it. So they have said publicly on their earnings calls, we are pulling employees out of Europe into the United States where they're not so encumbered.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's just so much European governments could lean into. And I think if you look at the EU, broadly speaking, like it's a massive, I mean, it's bigger than the US in terms of population. You have a real moment in time, right, to re-embrace technology.
Yes.
The right regulation and safety is absolutely needed in any shift. But it's like finding more of a balance. I was just in Paris at the opening of our first big footprint in Europe, actually. And I actually will give a lot of kudos to the French government. Like AI is a place they're really leaning in. And they have birthed some really interesting companies in France. And they are saying all the right things about innovation. So it's not that it can't be done, but it will take, backbone. And, it's like our Walmart board discussions, right? Nothing you invest in this year, or my OAI board meetings, nothing we invest this year is going to really be reaped until FY27 and FY28. And if anything, governments should have an even longer time frame, right, than companies.
I remember in the early days of the internet, France was there first. Mm-hmm. I was so impressed. And so I've always kept an eye on them. And we are getting more questions from Europeans and the UK. Wait a minute, why can't we grow a a venture capital culture here. Why can't, so half of the solution is understanding the problem. I think they are waking up. This, I agree with you. This is a great moment in time, but will they seize it? I was so surprised at what happened to the internet, you know, and the French just not really leading the charge in any great way once it was really underway.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think you could also interpret, it's like the regulatory thicket in Europe makes it difficult. It makes it difficult to grow a business inside of Europe, maybe even more difficult than it is, but it's also difficult to operate in Europe. And one of the interesting, I think, capabilities of AI systems is it could serve as a skeleton key to unlock bureaucracy in an automated way. As in, somebody write me a program that automatically clicks the allow cookies button for me so it never shows up again. And so then I no longer have to pay attention to that European regulation. Like, you know, so there's a way in which kind of like arcane infrastructure can be solved by having some kind of AI specific operating system that is running kind of your computational life. So circling back to OpenAI, actually, You mentioned like companies using AI should be able to do things better. Companies investing in AI should be able to do things better. There are lots of rumors about OpenAI maybe building their own chips or building their own browser, building their own device. Robots. You know, there's humanoid robot investments. Like within, you laid out capital allocation on how much am I going to invest in kind of the next model. But there's also kind of these broader strategic potential allocation decisions. How do those fit into the mix, and how do you even consider like whether or not that's strategically appropriate for OpenAI?
Yeah, I mean, I would start by saying, like, at our soul, we are a research lab, and researchers, thankfully, by their very nature, are hyper-curious. In fact, I just finished our research planning memo, right? We're in planning season for FY25. And right at the very end, they had this absolutely delicious quote from Albert Einstein about how curiosity is a little flower that needs to be tended, but most importantly, it needs freedom. I've totally bastardized that quote, but oh, I love this. So with curiosity, though, comes all the things you're talking about, that there's always something interesting and new on the horizon. And I think part of when we look at a new opportunity, it's number one, strategically, does this accelerate our path to AGI? That always has to be the first question we answer. And there's something to be said about, you know, if it's looking at chips, for example, does that allow us to do compute bigger, faster, better, cheaper, right? That would be a reason to look at that. On something like robotics, is there more data that you can collect that you can't collect today that allows you to really further educate your model, right? To, you know, we're learning to do things with synthetic data. We're learning to do evals with our API from customers who opt in to give us back evals. And we know that when that data goes back into the model gets inherently better. And I think one of the things that behooves us right now is we are so far ahead in terms of having built this really big base of customers that's continuing to grow at a pretty phenomenal clip. It really behooves us to kind of keep those flywheels going as fast as possible, because more data, better model, more customers, more data, and so on. So number one is strategically, does it accelerate us towards AGI? Number two is, what's the trade-off as well? Like, this is the phrase you will hear from me over and over again, is if we do that, what should we not do? Because we live in a world of finite resources. And then I think the third question is always, if we have the ability to go out and raise a lot of capital, should we go raise that bit more to do that thing? Because we have an ability right now to do it. I know that doesn't sound like a good CFO kind of framework, but it is literally the third thing I think about all the time, that if we are unconstrained, who might have constrained it at the moment? And we have a flight of an amazing set of brains that want to come work here. And you tend to find that, you know, the person who's fascinated by robotics, the person who's fascinated by chips, they in themselves create this community that just where curiosity thrives. So it's a long way to say that I am more inclined to let more flowers flourish, but I'm always thinking about, as a CFO, focus and like making sure that we don't end up with so many things going that we're not successful in any. That does mean that sometimes we partner. So you mentioned kind of hardware, and there's definitely been talks in the press about partnerships we may have done. And so I think that's an example where sometimes we decide not to do it ourselves, but we want to have a strong partnership so that we can at least nudge how something manifests in the world and make sure that if it really grows at a big clip, we also get to benefit from it, both from a data perspective and a financial perspective.
I have a question, maybe it's a little off, and if you have another one, Brett, please feel free, but the competitive dynamics out there, because that drives a lot of spending as well. There's, you know, we were keeping track of the model performance relative to benchmarks and seeing how quickly, you know, they were, you know, moving towards OpenAI's results or performance. And even the open source models, maybe improving at a faster pace than the closed models. How are you thinking about competition in this space and generally?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. I think number one, we try to really stay eyes on the prize, right? For us, how do we get to AGI and not getting too distracted by just the noise out there. That said, we take evaluations and model, like comparing model outcomes very seriously, right? We look at that every day, every week, all the time. We're talking about it. And in fact, I know our research team really wants to show with this next family of reasoning models, O1, and then what will come, O2, and so on, that we can really kind of blast these overall kind of stats out of the water, frankly, when you start to see just how good these models can perform at PhD level plus plus tasks. I think the second thing on the open source front, it is, I mean, there is a thesis that says what we are learning is as you get out onto that edge, that real frontier. And I just watched a researcher externally, and I don't want to talk about where they are, but think lab in the United States that's absolutely kind of at the forefront, come in and show us how he was using O1, not O1 preview, but O1, to go through, I think maybe it was like near and dear to my heart, because he was shocking a metal so hard to effectively unleash the electrons to create a shockwave of energy as he was thinking about, you know, ultimately, how do you get nuclear fusion to work? And he kind of walked through, right? He's like, this answer, good graduate level. This answer, yeah, PhD student that I would support. This answer, yeah, someone with a PhD has probably got, you know, a decade of experience. Okay, this answer, this is me. I am literally the world's expert. This answer, I don't know. I need to figure out, like, if this answer is correct. Maybe the model is smarter. And so when you have moments like that, what you start to understand is that human evals become really important.
Yeah.
They're expensive because suddenly you're asking the best in the world to take the time to give you an evaluation of your model. And can open source really fund that and do that? I know this is an area that we're spending a lot of time and focus on as we think about FY25. And so it's interesting to think, is there some divergence at this point from who can really stay on the frontier because it's expensive to stay there versus open source that can be good enough maybe for a range of broader experiences, but maybe not quite where you want to be. And I just think when technology changes happen, you want to be the frontier.
Yeah,
you just need to be, because you don't even know what you're about to discover. And if you're just kind of okay, that's never been a good place to be in tech, in my mind. It's okay when markets mature. I think you can have more, because then you have more choice. People maybe don't want to pay as much and so on. But in that moment of like breakthrough innovation, I have always, I mean, it's just stylistically as an investor, even all in on the number one. And I wouldn't even do like 20% on number two. I'm just like a big believer in number one, because it's easier to grow into multiples when you have super high growth. It's really hard when you don't have a lot of growth to ever hit a multiple.
Right.
Can I ask a clarifying question about that anecdote? Were the different examples that the researcher was highlighting, were those different inference times of the same model?
Yeah, it was effectively, he was further prompting the model. The model was holding state. So the model knew what the original kind of premise was, like what sort of metal, what sort of force was being applied to it. And then he was just pushing it to go deeper and deeper with each prompt. So the other thing about the reasoning model, right, it holds state, which is different from if you're just using 4.0s. Like every question's a little bit of a new question. And by the way, that's another thing that we're learning in all of these models is the power of personalization to create stickiness, but also to just create a better and better human intelligence-like answer, right? It would be like if every day I walked into work and I met my EA for the first time, it'd be a really frustrating experience for both of us. The state that he has of having worked with me for 7 or 8 years now, he knows me better than I know myself. And I love that and value it. And it means his answers are much better. As we think about models, like, and they're doing more and more personal tasks for you and then professional tasks, innovative tasks, the more they can hold state over time, I think is also going to become a big differentiator.
What does OpenAI use for evals internally right now? Do you have your own custom stack of evaluations you're doing? Because a lot of the benchmarks seem frustratingly, call it limited slash skewed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we do look at the external benchmarks and kind of look at where the tastemakers are and use those. But yes, internally, we definitely, you know, for things like coding and so on, we'll look to our own kind of staff in a way. We do go out into the world and work on the human data side with finding evals from these best in class evaluators of either, you know, if it's best in class in physics or biology, but it might also be, you know, I don't know, Romanian something or other, right? It becomes very specific and you want to make sure the model's giving the right answer. We also remember, right, evals even just into plain old ChatGPT. Like often if you'll see, you'll get the two answers and you get to choose which one. We've learned to balance this too, by the way, because it is a bit of a synthetic moment when you're asked to look at two answers. Humans actually tend to pick the more verbose answer because we're like, oh, that looks great. Look how knowledgeable it is. But then if every single time you get a super verbose answer, it's actually not that useful. And so we're kind of learning all of these like balances of like taking in the input, but making sure we don't overtrain the model to go one direction. There's a lot of learning along the way.
It really does seem like one of the characteristics that's so wildly different about AI is you ship a product that you're not certain what its capabilities are. As in, like in Photoshop, you decide on a new menu item. That's the beta that's like, oh, this is the menu item. And then, you know, it's tested and you know exactly what it does when you ship it. And maybe it's buggy, but here you need the user base to try the thing to figure out what it can actually do.
This is something when I'm with customers that always sounds a little disingenuous, but I keep trying to lean into it and figure out a way to say it, which is they're like, should I buy wall-to-wall ChatGPT? What's the use case? Like I talk to CFOs, they're like, can we buy the use case that is, you know, closing the books or it's doing procurement RFPs or whatever? We're like, and I keep saying, don't do that. You actually want to go wall-to-wall ChatGPT, but then let us either come in and help you or, you know, there's more and more little boutiques springing up to help with this. Like you should do hackathons. You should do like more open-ended focus groups with, you know, employees, say in your finance department or your marketing department or whatever, because what they come up with is in many ways far more creative than if we give you the button from Photoshop, right? You know, that said, I think CTOs, CIOs obviously are like, well, show me the money, right? There really needs to be like a real POC here. Like show me that, you know, how Klarna did, you know, customer service, or show me how Morgan Stanley's doing wealth management, or show me how, you know, insert someone else paradigm or Moderna is using it around vaccine deployment and so on. But I think being too narrow on that, we're going to miss entirely what this technology is for. You know, again, going back to your electricity example, right? If you came in and said, electricity is just for turning on a light bulb. Yeah, we'd have light bulbs all over the nation, but you might have missed the, you know, everything else the technology ultimately got used for.
Since you did come out of software as a service in a prior life, what you just described was more customization per company, right? As the costs of doing this come down. So it seems to us, and we do have a thesis, that the tech stack is going to shift a little bit away from software as a service to infrastructure and platform as a service. That seems to be what you just said.
Yeah, I think it's actually, Brett, earlier when you were describing like this layer on top of bureaucracy, I think about that a lot with where the world of compute will go from here. And I think software stocks were very troubled by this, like all through the year, because of this worry that if you went down a level and all the intelligence lay at the top layer, you're getting subsumed, like your brand, your UI, everything. It certainly feels like AI, and again, this is actually not a commentary about what OpenAI is developing right now, but it feels like it could and should be a layer atop, particularly when the technology gets smart enough to be able to quickly go search and retrieve within an organization. And when you get up into that agentic layer where you're kind of setting it off to do a task, but then it's able to go access each of the kind of apps as we think about them today. And then maybe do you need that app layer at all? Because all that's doing is going through a translation layer where there's a transformation happening back into a data lake. And so is there a way to just cut out the middleman? Like, it's going to take a long time, but there's certainly something interesting at that intelligence layer. Or said another as a thought bubble, because it kind of blew my mind, but I don't quite know how to, you know, you'll do a better job, Kathy, ultimately explaining this. But I was meeting with one of our really incredible researchers and asking if in FY25, should we be creating customized UIs for healthcare and finance and EDU? And then even within that, customized UIs based on the task that they were working on. And he kind of looked at me quizzically. And then he was like, Sarah, these models are already so intelligent that they can just create the UI on the fly for whatever it is that you want to be able to do, which kind of blew my mind. We're not there yet, but imagine a UI that's not static. Bits and bytes have been developed that make the button blue or it opens up with a certain look and feel, but rather, you know, today, if you're using Canvas, which, you know, is available already in OpenAI, it knows if you're coding and it knows if you're writing. Those are kind of two such basic beginning points. But what if it knows I'm writing in a CRM system? Or what if it knows that I'm editing a photo in a Photoshop type system? Like, what does that ultimately mean for that layer? And I don't know yet.
Can I just interject? Because we've come to learn about this concept, and maybe it's not exactly what you're talking about, with Palantir, which is an intelligent layer on top of all of this legacy software, which over time it will usurp, you know, the role just because it's going to be so much more efficient. I think, yes, that feels like how this is going to happen, or at least one way it's going to happen.
Yeah. And I think the UI becomes natural language, right? That's what's more interesting, right? As a CFO, I walk into work and I'm like, hey, you know, how are all our user metrics today? I don't actually say that to anyone. I go call up my dashboard and I go look and I track my thing along. But what if everything were just more natural language? That gets super interesting. It's always been the great white promise, right? You know, when I started life as a software analyst, TIBCO, the information bus yes. company, right, was the layer that was going to take away all the stuff underneath. Brett has just died. He's like, oh my God, she's talking about TIBCO now. But it's just another abstraction layer. But I think where technology has often shut people out is because it's not intuitive. And I think multimodal gets really interesting done well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also, I mean, I think that any technology that is consumer or business facing, like, complexifies beyond the user's ability to use it over time. Like, even iOS, which is, you know, this magical consumer interface. Now there's so many like little knobs you can tweak there that I have no like use for any of them because I would need to learn them all. But I can't like turn off the automatic alarm that happens every weekday on the weekends because I can't remember how to get back to that in the user interface, you know. And so kind of, or it, and there's plenty of examples of kind of technology agony that people have, which I classify under the world is heavily under software. Like, we yeah. don't have software interface layers between all of these gadgets that are in our lives that then allow the gadgets to work together well. And so one way to think about AI is this is a new operating system layer for all of that stuff, for the whole stack. And you know, anybody that can speak a language can then interact with it and get it to do at least close to roughly what you want. Whereas now it's like, you know, changing iOS's settings is now like reprogramming the VCR. It's like, we will never have to learn how to do that, hopefully, because there will be a layer on top.
It's true. It's in product development, there's a product development framework called Jobs to be Done, right? And it's like, what's the job, right? You know, you don't need a 10-inch drill. You need a hole in the wall that hangs a picture frame, right? It's like Clayton Christensen kind of was the architect of it. And I think we're moving back more and more to that. Like, what is the job I'm actually trying to get done rather than how do I learn to program all of these things?
Before we go, I have to, you had a conversation with Charlie Roberts, who is spearheading our venture team. And he mentioned that you mentioned something about an operating system on the fly according to need, which is maybe related to what we've just talked about.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how you're describing it.
Yeah, that's how I think about it. It's just this, like, it pulls up and does the thing, and then it tears back down. Because as humans, right, we go about our day, and we have many different kind of moments. You know, I might be creating a speech for my team. I might be creating an Excel model to model out my capital allocation. I might be doing some coding. My controller all the time is constantly looking for ways to use Python scripts to shorten our close, so we're not dumping CSV files into Excel and so on. And so today, there's no software on this world that kind of has a user interface that is dynamic like that. And that's, again, what I get really interested in, because I think, Brett, to your point, I think the point you were making is that we think we have a lot of technology in the world, but actually we still really don't. And for a lot of the world, they're excluded from it, not just because of kind of the wealth gap, like you can go down that track, but I think more because of just ability to use, right? You know, people over a certain age find technology tough. My mom has macular degeneration. She can't see stuff. Kids, like, you know, really kind of learn technology as the ability to, you know, hit your, you know, it's funny to me when my kids started to try to change the TV by touching it, because they grew up in a world where touchscreen was just a thing. Yeah. And so, you know, if technology just becomes a lot more intuitive, how much more, going back to like human intelligence, are we now gifting the world? And is that is our path to AGI, right?
Right, right. And we're saving people the, you know, and the automotive space, the laborious burden of actually manually operating the vehicle. And in the everyday life space, like the burden of kind of like the thing that is kludgy and doesn't really work and isn't doing what you want it to do, not because it's not capable, but because the interface is right. Misunderstood, broken, poorly designed.
Exactly.
How do you price that? As the CFO, as we're like, okay, so the magical tool, here's, I'll give you $1,000 a month. Like, how do you price an agent in fiscal year 25 that can provide this magical defrictioning of all technological experience?
Oh, this is where I so want to, I mean, I was torturing one of our pricing folks this morning on value-based pricing.
Yeah.
Because there are some tasks that you can't price on like time to get the answer or use or even like tokens, because it could be almost a priceless task moment for them that might take seconds and very little compute, actually. I think we need more building blocks in place right now as a company, right? We have our subscription model, but can we get into more usage-driven models? How do we think about, you know, having just said that I don't want to create customized user interfaces, but how do I know the quality or the value of the task that you're doing? I should be able to know that. And then, you know, I even get interested in like, can we use the agentic technology to kind of price itself on the fly? Like, why not? It's way more intelligent than probably most of us on pricing. But just like the feeling I want to have, I'm actually not going to give you a great answer, but the feeling I want to have is when software as a service and the cloud came along, that actually really made my career, because I spent like a whole summer teaching myself like these deferred revenue models and building these waterfalls and proving that for these companies, there was going to be this kind of trough that they went through and then got to the other side. And it was so painful. Like, no one believed that you could actually pay for software in a subscription way. To your point, at the very beginning of this call, Kathy, Oracle went out of their way to explain why perpetual licenses were Absolutely. The best business model ever. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think we have revolutionized that yet. But I guess I'm very optimistic because I think we are just learning how to even eat our own dog food or drink our own champagne to have these models help us begin to think about pricing as well. But I think it's going to be crawl, walk, run. We've started with the basic subscription model. I think we want to think about more usage-driven models over time. In the enterprise, we're thinking about more and more wall-to-wall to allow people to experiment. But yeah, I think we're going to have this conversation in a year or 2 years from now. I'm going to say, see, I told you we were just beginning.
When we were, you know, evaluating OpenAI, we were trying to say, okay, what, let's imagine, you know, if this could take the place of four engineers, what would we be willing to pay in order to customize our own, you know, software for our own business and become that much more efficient? And, you know, Brett, I think you threw out $1,000, or we were reading something that said $1,000 or $2,000 a month. That'd be inexpensive for, you know, this kind of an engineer, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, as an ex-CEO, every time you sit down with any team, maybe it's just because I was at a tech company, the bottleneck was always access to engineers. Like, yes. It was either we didn't have enough money to go hire enough of them, or we had enough money, but we couldn't get them through the pipeline fast enough. And so suddenly, if you could spawn, you know, an agentic software engineer, I mean, it feels like it is an incredible force multiplier for any business. And I think that there's a lot of value, you know, both to the customer, but then can also be brought back to OpenAI or to the ecosystem to kind of then keep reinvesting in the flywheel.
Most people are kind of, they're used to a model, okay, $25 per month, it'll go up a little bit with time as they add more value. No. Yeah. We're talking a step function here, right?
Agreed.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Leave us with as you're walking off into the sunset to allocate capital to billions of dollars of chips, where, like, when we have this conversation 12 months from now, presumably the agents will have been released. They'll be out there in the world. And what will we be looking forward to, or what do you think will be kind of like the focus of that next conversation?
So what I would say to listeners is, first and foremost, we are just at the beginning. You have not gotten left behind yet, but we are in the beginning, but you need to jump aboard because this train has left the station and is accelerating. I would tell everyone to think really critically about how are you integrating AI into your own businesses, but also into your lives, because I think often it starts personally, but how are you bringing it professionally? And whatever that level is, you now need to quadruple it and go do that. And I'm excited to talk in 12, 24 months from now about how AI is solving the world's toughest problems and just the scientific breakthroughs that we're going to see.
Can I just add one more thing? It's where we started, and many people may not have understood the reference, Sarah, to Sig Sigalis. Sig Sigalis was one of the founders of Janison Associates. I was at Janison for 18 years. He was my mentor and gave me my big breaks in the business. He believed so much in you, Sarah. And actually, he gave a lot of women their big breaks in our industry, especially if they had anything to do with technology. So I know how much he admired you, Sarah, and I think we lost him in the last year or so, and so we will miss him, but we will carry on for him, right, Sarah?
Exactly. We are carrying that torch. Thank you, yes. Kathy, for yes. being such an inspiration yourself.
Oh. Well, thank you, and you as well, Sarah. Thank you, and congratulations for all of your success. We're excited for you.
Perfect.
What a fascinating conversation with Sarah and Kathy. I certainly use ChatGPT a lot, both in my personal and professional life. And as Sarah said, I'd encourage all of you to do so. There's nothing like experimenting with the technology to understand, you know, where its capabilities actually lie and where the limitations currently are. As described in the episode, we think the performance improvements in AI It's a rough doubling per dollar spent every 4 to 5 months. And as you can see from the business results, capital is flowing in to fund, you know, additional R&D efforts and additional model capability. So it really will be exciting to see how powerful these systems are 12 and 24 months from now. Roughly over the course of 2 to 3 years, we think the systems will improve by 100 to 1,000x. A way to think about that is that the first iPhone to today's iPhone is roughly 100 to 1,000x as capable in terms of at least its CPU processing speed. So thank you so much for joining us on FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. Please like and subscribe on whatever podcasting platform you are conditioned to listen to. Go out and try as many AI systems as you can, and please tune in again next week.
ARC believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARC. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.